What I want us to do for the next couple of weeks is kind of continue exploring the universe a little bit, just to, you know, keep it close to home. And it's worth remembering, I think, that right from the beginning of this exploration of the universe, that there are lots of people that are on these kind of quests, this kind of exploratory way of thinking about where we are and what that has to do with everyday things. But lots of those explorers start with a different set of presuppositions than we might generally start with in this room. I don't know how many of you have seen this, but Colin, if you want to put this picture up. It's a little hard to see pictures in here, but I was at a stoplight this past week, and not this bus, but a bus that looked exactly like this, roared by, and I could read about what you can read on that slide, because I was just sitting and it went at right angles to me, just zoomed by, and this huge bus board that said, "Don't believe in God," and that was sort of all I saw, right? And it was gone. And I thought, I gotta know, so I chased it. And I was like, what? Right? And my poor kids. Yeah, we're going home. No, this isn't the way we usually go. Anyway, so this is the actual next slide for which Colin. I did give you two, right? Okay. There's a clearer version of this. So this is what the bus board says. And they're all over the city this week. Don't believe in God, you're not alone. Humanists, atheists, and agnostics in Manitoba, and a website. And I just thought, that is so fascinating. Like, what an interesting ad campaign. What a curious choice. And so, when I got home, I, you know, asked Uncle Google about it. And this is the press release that goes with this ad campaign. I'm going to read you the whole press release. And then hopefully it'll make sense why I gave it that much time and space. This is, just listen to this. It's awesome. And I'm not being facetious. The Humanist, Atheists, and Agnostics of Manitoba is thrilled to announce its new atheist bus advertisements in Winnipeg. The ads, which reach out to non-believers with the simple message, "You are not alone," will run on select Winnipeg buses through the month of September. Recent statistics, pay attention to the linkages in this next paragraph, we'll come back to them. Recent Statistics Canada survey numbers show that fewer people in Manitoba go to church than ever before. As a result of fewer people going to church than ever before, many non-believers feel disconnected because they are not aware of organizations such as HAM, H-A-A-M. They must have wrestled with that acronym. Anyways, that's not the point. Let's keep going. As humanists, back to the quote, as humanists, we offer them a safe place to question faith, religion, the concept of God, and their own place in a healthy, productive society. Quote, we feel that advertisements on buses were a good method of reaching a diverse cross-section of Winnipeg's population, close quote, said Donna Harris, president of HAM. Jeffrey Olson, past president of HAM, a member of the Clergy Project and the author of Leaving Faith Behind, offered his perspective as a former Anglican priest, now an atheist. Quote, I truly felt alone in my unbelief until I met the wonderful people in the Humanist Association of Manitoba. They gave me a safe place to question and test what I believed and helped me make the transition from faith to reason. There must be other people out there who are dealing with the same issues I dealt with. This bus advertising campaign intends to find those people. Pat Morrow, HAM's outreach coordinator. Is that like evangelist? Adobe uses that language, right? So why shouldn't these guys? You can have a business card for the executive level of that organization. It says evangelist on it. Pat Morrow, HAM's outreach coordinator, offered these insights. Quote, often atheists and other non-believers feel isolated, especially in religious communities. This campaign is all about reaching out to them and letting the public know there is a vibrant community of non-believers out there. We welcome people questioning their faith and those recovering from religion. We're a community of people who understand where they're coming from and offer a hopeful perspective on how to move forward. Close quote. Okay. Does any of this sound familiar? Like, it sounds like HAM's reason for existing as a collective and our reason for existing as a collective are almost identical. Maybe that's why I was cheering for the bus ad. I just gonna get out there at night with my stencils and my spray paint can, you know, and change the web address on the bottom or something. I mean, listen to this. As humanists, we offer them a safe place to question faith, religion, the concept of God, and their own place in a healthy, productive society. So aside from saying that my starting place is not self-identification as a humanist, and that I don't like them and us language, which the press release is loaded with, I'm in. This is a fantastic mission. I've never been inside of this group, and so I don't know anything about it from the inside, but I wonder, I can't help but wonder, if they struggle with some of the same things I do. And in particular, I wonder if they struggle with being genuinely open to the possibility that the starting propositions are not valid. By which I mean, it seems to me like this organization and any faith community of other kinds might have the same problem when it comes to genuinely exploring belief in dialogue, which is that as long as we take a big piece like God exists or God doesn't exist out of the dialogue, we've got a problem from go with it being an honest dialogue. The existence of God, period, has to be on the table for dialogue to be genuine. That possibility has to exist somewhere in our imagination if we're going to have a deeply fruitful conversation about the nature of faith. Because it is one of the possibilities. If it isn't one of the possibilities, any more than God's non-existence isn't one of the possibilities, we've truncated the dialogue before we've even got it off the ground. If you want to have an interesting day, try being a Christian preacher on your way to work wondering if God exists at all. Anyway, that's a story for another day. So we have all this common ground, all these shared desires to have a sense of belonging that doesn't require buy-in. And I think that's really interesting. And maybe there's some serious exploration that we should do about this profound sense of not wanting to be lonely and how central it is to all of this, but we'll do that another day. One other thing, though, that really struck me in this press release was Jeffrey Olson, this former Anglican priest's language, when he talks about the importance of this association, this community of people, being essential to assisting him with, quote, making the transition from faith to reason. When I read that sentence, what I felt was, my emotional response was sadness. I thought, what a loss in anyone's life, but in Mr. Olson's life, certainly he articulated it. And when I chased that emotion down a little bit more inside of me, I realized that space, the feeling that I was having, felt a bit like the feeling that I've had as a musician when I'm cleaning up after a gig. Which was interesting to me. It was sort of this same, or after a party. And I kept thinking about it a little bit more, and I realized, you know what, one way to articulate that emotion for me that I felt when I read that phrase and felt that feeling was that it's like, what? No more dancing? No more? Party's over? There's nothing that could bring these things together. Faith and reason, we have to just say that's that. Clean up the mess. And I felt sad about that. But I remain intrigued by how familiar it all is. And so in some ways, in mentioning all of that, I've given us a context for our explanation, our exploration this morning. And that context is important. We talked a couple of weeks ago about how deeply our understanding of the world is informed by our Enlightenment heritage, these ideas that have launched this whole project that has given us the Western culture that we now know and benefit by in large. The idea of science as an objective observer and how that kind of observation in our culture and our time remains something that is understood to be the kind of thinking and observation and testing that gives an idea merit. And that even though we know things in ways other than that, that other kind of knowing is suspect when laid against the kind of knowing that we would call scientific knowing. So those are things that we touched on a couple of weeks ago. And what I want to do this morning is chase down some other of our basic assumptions about the universe a bit more, and we'll do some more of this next week. The good news is that science hasn't stopped exploring. That it's not like these Enlightenment ideas represent the last word in discovery from a scientific point of view. And our scientific explorations in our culture suffer, I suppose, still, maybe less than they did, I don't know, but still from hubris, from this kind of overweening sense of confidence that if we just keep chasing this down by this method, we will eventually come to the end of all it is, and then we will have finished the job. We will know whatever the thing is that we might call truth or final knowledge. But that problem aside, the discoveries continue to be fascinating. They continue to come at a pretty blistering rate, and they continue to take us to some very interesting places. And one of the things that modern science has discovered is that the universe is expanding. I'm going to give you some big numbers because, again, context for our exploration is important, and we just need to try to get our imagination at least engaged with some of this. The edge of the universe is about 90 billion trillion miles away from where we are this morning. The visible universe is a million, 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 million miles across. So that's the universe we can observe. All the galaxies in our universe are moving away from all the other galaxies in the universe at the same time. It's called galactic dispersal. That's what's happening in our universe. Our solar system, this particular little bit of our universe that's ours, uses up less than 1/1,000,000,000th of the available space in our galaxy. Okay, not in our universe, in our galaxy. Milky Way is our galaxy. And that solar system that we live in is moving at a speed of 558,000 miles an hour. Close your eyes. If you feel vertigo, there's a reason. Even at that speed, and that's pretty fast, even at that speed, it takes our solar system between 200 and 250 million years to orbit our own galaxy once. Anybody struggling yet? Okay, I don't do math. You know, I've confessed that already. Our galaxy contains several other galaxies, all of which are part of a larger group of 54 galaxies, which are in turn part of yet another larger group of galaxies, and they're all expanding outwards at a rate of about 666,000 miles an hour. Boom. So that's a lot of big numbers. This is a big place that we inhabit a very small corner of. And here's the thing. It's not just big. It's unpredictable. For instance, when we started talking about things on this scale, the stuff that we think that we can count on in our universe ceases to be dependable. For instance, we've probably heard somebody describe something that's predictable or inevitable in nature as being as sure as death, gravity, and taxes. You jump off the roof of the house, you know what's going to happen. Bam, right? You throw a paper airplane, eventually it's going to come down. We can keep going, but we do depend on, we count on, this thing we call gravity, to behave a certain way. But if we keep moving outward in our exploration of our universe, it doesn't take us very long before we discover that there are places in our own universe where gravity is not especially reliable. Celestial bodies out there called neutron stars, they have such a strong internal gravity that they collapse in on themselves. Those stars can sometimes weigh more than 200 billion tons, which is more collective weight than all the continents on Earth put together. One star can weigh more than that. And here's the crazy bit. That star, because of its internal gravity, can fit in a teaspoon. But it weighs more than all the continents of Earth. Then, there's the fact that if we keep exploring outwards, we discover that 96% of our universe is made up of black holes, dark matter, and dark energy. In fact, as far as we can tell, that stuff that we name that way seems to be the engine of life in our universe, and we can kind of tell that, but that's about it. That's about all we can tell about it. And so that leaves us in our outward exploration with about 4% of the universe that's knowable and an obvious corner that we are exploring, the numbers for which are mind-bogglingly small, as I've already mentioned, would be Earth. So our home this little, almost unimaginably small portion of the thing I've just been describing. It weighs about 6 billion trillion tons. It's moving around the sun at about 66,000 miles an hour, and it's doing that while rotating at the equator at a little over 1,000 miles an hour. So if you're in Paris and you look up at the Eiffel Tower and you feel lightheaded, it's because you're traveling about 600 miles an hour at that point on the globe. The surface, the part we find the easiest to explore, is made up of 10 big plates and about 20 smaller ones, and they're always moving. Greenland moves about an inch a year. I keep waiting for Vancouver to surf down to Seattle. The generally accepted estimate of how long the continents as we know them have been in this configuration that we see them in is about 0.1% of the history of the planet. So not only is gravity not a universal constant, even the ground we walk on is quite literally shifting. We know that our Earth is traveling around the sun once every 365 days or so. We know that it spins around once every 24 hours, and we call that a day. That's a long on-ramp to an important idea. Our concept of time is based on the particular details of the physical movement of physical bodies around one another in a very small part of a very large universe. If we take away the physical reality of our planet, we no longer have a concept of time. Now, I can hear some of you going, well, if there's no planet, then there's nobody here to care. Like, whatever, buddy. Nice, that's nice. Off you go. Whoever that mentor was that said you should make application was right. This is, to me, this is where it gets interesting when it comes to talking about God and belief in God. We've taken these constructs that we have about time, and we've divided them up into these nice predictable units, days, hours, minutes, and that's helpful because unless your church happens to be the table, it helps you get to church on time and, you know, not miss appointments and remember birthdays and like all this kind of stuff, right? But on the other hand, it's not a deliberate pun, it's not helpful, this concept of time, because it keeps a very important truth away from us. And that truth is that time is not linear and predictable. It's elastic. If I took two clocks, I put one of them on the ground, I put another one on a tower, the hands of the clock on the tower are going to run faster than the hands of the clock on the ground. This elasticity of time is that present to our lived reality. And that's because of the force of gravity acting on the hands of the clock. If I lay on the tramp outside with my kids at night and we look at the stars, we're seeing the stars as they were many, many, many years ago. If I go out and stand in the sunshine, I'm feeling the sunshine as it was 8 minutes ago. If I could get my van to go the speed of light, aside from the fact that I'd have to go in for service work right away, if I could get my van to go the speed of light, I would cease to see things coming in the future, things beside me in the present, things behind me in the past. They would all conflate into one now. There would be no past, present, and future. There would only be now if I was traveling at the speed of light. Time is elastic. It's not a constant. That means, among other things, that there is, in this universe that we inhabit, no universal up or down. There is no unmoving place from which we can observe anything. It's all moving all the time. Among the other implications of that understanding of our universe, the place where we believe or don't believe, the place where we read a bus ad like that and go looking for help with the idea that there is no God and what does that mean, the place where we gather like this around the idea that there is a God and wrestle with what does that mean, that universe, among the other implications of these things that our contemporary version of the scientific way of exploring the universe have handed us, is the implication that there is no absolute point of view. There are only views from the point where we are. This is important for a bunch of reasons, not the least of which is that as people who are exploring Christian faith, we reference a sacred text. And that text has been a point of view from different actual bits of chronology, represents a gathering of stories from many different points of view. And if we treat it as though it all comes from our point of view, we've missed the gist of what I've been on about this whole morning, among other things. Not like that's the biggest crisis in the world if we miss the gist of that. But we also, when we do that kind of work in that really not helpful way, we also rip ourselves off really big when it comes to what the exploration of the life of faith and the nature of God and what that has to do with the world we live in every day could be. Because what we're trying to do is turn God into a being that behaves as though there were fixed points in this story. Think about just the information we have about our universe from this last few minutes. And then think about the utter absurdity of Christendom having a pissing contest about whether Genesis happened in 6 24-hour days. You see the problem? Wow. What a complete and utter waste of energy. It doesn't matter. It really doesn't. And as soon as we can start to imagine how little some of our fixed point concepts matter in the exploration of faith, we can start to imagine the possibilities that come with the existence of a God that is not bound by our concepts, including our concept of time. See, it doesn't matter how the earth was created time-wise, because the idea that we have of time is a mechanical one that we've built on knowledge that we've gained very, very recently in our very, very brief history about the movement of the physical bit of the universe on which we live. And then we started measuring it in predictable increments mechanistically, and we called that time. And then we brought that concept of time to our reading of this enormous story about the existence of this thing that is the universe, the corner of which we live in, is called Earth. Do you see how quick we can shrink God when we do this? Do you see how easy it becomes when we depend on fixed point thinking to say, no, God is actually like our concept of God, not like your concept of God. And by the way, I feel so strongly about that that I believe I may kill you because you disagree with me. In fact, I think my whole country is going to kill your whole country because we disagree about this. In fact, if your country would just behave like the way my country behaves because of what we believe, then I wouldn't have to go attack your mall and get this? See, these bits are connected. When we think small about the nature of God, we start to think small about everything. When we start to think small, the exploration of the possibilities that we call faith or belief shrink along with everything else. And we end up with the kind of sadness that we encountered in Ham's press release, where faith and reason don't get to dance together anymore. I find it an interesting and sometimes really challenging exercise to read some of our ancient sacred texts in Christendom and try to imagine what the writer would have written had they had access to the information that we all have access to. We can't explore from some other vantage point than the one we have. This is who we are. We are limited beings in this iteration. There may be no fixed point of view. There may only be views from a point, but we are at some point, and from that point we explore. Listen to this. I'm going to read you one of the creation psalms. Okay? And I would invite you to try to imagine what the writer would have written had they had the fairly banal version of the information about the universe that I've been able to give us as a non-science guy this morning. So here's the psalm. Oh, and by the way, there's already a word in it that we don't know the meaning of anymore. For the director of music, so it's song lyrics, according to Gittin. That's the one we don't know. How we translated it, Gittin, is another story. Psalm of David. O Lord, our Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth. You have set your glory in the heavens. Through the praise of children and infants, you have established a stronghold against your enemies to silence the foe and the avenger. When I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars, which you have set in place, what is mankind that you are mindful of them, human beings, that you care for them? You have made them a little lower than the angels and crowned them with glory and honor. You have made them rulers over the works of your hands. You put everything under their feet. All flocks and herds and the animals of the wild, the birds in the sky and the fish in the sea, all that swim in the paths of the seas. Lord, our Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth. Leave it to the poets to make some space for things they don't know, as well as saying things that they think they do. There's a lot of fixed points in this poet's universe. There is, however, also a being that is not that. It's fascinating. The ancient view of the universe is clearly visible in the language of the poem. Things are set in place. They're constants. They're not moving. Something we now know is not the case. And yet, somehow, with those limitations, the possibility of knowing and being known by a glorious being that the psalmist names Yahweh in this particular psalm. The first Lord in this psalm is that name of God for the Hebrews. The possibility of our exploration leading us into the knowledge of and the reciprocating care of that being is here in this piece of poetry. Good science, I mean, this poem predates the existence of anything that we would call science. But the best science of the day is something that the king has access to when he writes. And that's his point of view. And from that point of view, he offers us a window of possibility into the knowing of God. That's what our science does too. And it doesn't even necessarily do it any better than this science. But if we let it, it will do that, among other things. When the biblical writers remind us that the Creator is a mystery, that we can't fully know. We can easily affirm that, given that we can't even fully know the behavior of something as everyday as gravity. And it's true that there are big obvious things that are right in front of us that we can't know. And if that's true, what makes us think that it would be a good idea to insist that we have a corner or a last word on things that we can't see? And now as the one of the characters, I think it was, might have been Pay It Forward, I'm not sure, said about his work in the world, what I do is I get up in the morning, I have a good breakfast, and I come here and I hand the ball to you. Now we go explore, we go wrestle. And it's in that wrestling that we're formed. And that the thing that we would think of as our spirituality, as our faith, is formed. That God, by God's goodness, meets us. And next week, we're going to, instead of exploring outward in the universe, we're going to explore inward for a little bit. And I'm not a science guy, but it's pretty intriguing what we can learn there and what it can provoke in our imagination about what it means to search for God.